everyone. Welcome to the Inspire to Fire podcast. My name is Chris and I'm your host, and this is episode 2 of season 2. So welcome back if you guys have been listening. And if you guys are new to the show, this show is all about helping you reach financial independence. And we do that by interviewing some amazing guests from the FIRE community, the personal finance community, and we just pick their brains on different things, different tactics that they've used to reach financial independence. So last week, we started the season with Tanya Hester, and I thought that was an amazing episode. She went over her financial independence journey, but also what we can do to give back to the planet and to society. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, go ahead and check it out. And again, if you're new to the show, go ahead and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. But today, we're going to switch it up a bit, and we're going to talk to Jerry from The Millionaire Educator. And Jerry is someone who reached financial independence on a teacher's salary. And he also got off to a late start. So he actually started at net zero pretty much at the age of 33. And he still was able to reach financial independence again on a teacher's salary. So we're going to dive into that and exactly how he did it. But just a sneak peek, he had something called magic money in his back pocket. And we're going to go ahead and get into that in the show. But it might not be what you think. So you might be thinking, he had something. No, he was able to use something that all teachers actually might have access to. And it's kind of a secret weapon in terms of reaching financial independence just that much quicker. We're also going to discuss his 7 pillars of FI. And lastly, he's also going to be talking to us about how he pretty much earned 2 years worth of college credits in a matter of a month or so. And this is at a significantly discounted rate. And this is what he's doing with his son, actually, at this time. So I'm excited. There's a lot of strategies, as I mentioned, and tips and awesome advice that you can take from this episode. So I hope you enjoy it. So don't forget, again, subscribe, leave a review. I really appreciate it. Share the episodes with a friend. And let's get into the interview. So actually, before getting into the interview, Jerry and I had some technical difficulties at the beginning of the episode, so we weren't able to record his money story, and I think that's such an important part of the whole story, so I want to try to summarize it as best as I can, and then we'll jump into the episode directly. But just a little bit about his money story. Jerry and his wife are a retired teaching couple who recently worked at their dream job. In their early 30s, they had about $45,000 of student loan debt. So financially, it was an uphill battle ever since then. And along the way, they had many adventures, as he described it. They started a family, and they actually reached financial independence. So on their journey at the beginning of the financial independence journey, they began by teaching in Saudi Arabia in 1996. Jerry took a job teaching ESL, while Mrs. Millionaire Educator finished her MBA. He recently had finished his MBA, so he was eager to start earning money at that point. In his 5 years in Saudi, he was able to pay off their student loan debt and save about $100,000. So without a doubt, their time overseas helped them right their financial ship, and they took care of those student loans and also laid a solid financial foundation during that time. In December of 2001, he moved back to the U.S., and started looking for teaching jobs. Initially, they thought they would live and teach in Texas. However, things didn't go as planned, and eventually they found jobs in LaGrange, Georgia, where they lived for 7 years. During that time, Jerry and his wife took advantage of 403b retirement accounts, as well as 457 accounts, which are available to many teachers, and public service jobs as well. And they contributed the maximum to each, and that helped them minimize their tax burden. So Jerry was able to use money from previous 457 plans to pay for their current expenses while contributing to their current retirement accounts. And this was a secret, or I guess it's not so much a secret, but it is less known in the financial world that this is something that you can do to actually control your tax rate and choose which tax rate you'd like to pay. So that is a little bit about his money story. And then we go deeper into exactly how he did it and so much more and his salary and everything. So Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Again, we had some technical difficulties, but I thought that that was important to share. So now with that, we can go into the show. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Awesome. Me too. So you go by the Millionaire Educator, and I read a ton of your stuff on your blog. That's where actually I found you, and then I found you on other podcasts as well. And you talk a lot about the 457 plan and free money, which we're going to get into hopefully as well. Year by year, you have that post. That's awesome. So before we get into some of those topics, though, if you wouldn't mind going a little bit into your background and just giving the audience a little bit about who you are and what you've been through and, you know, your FI journey, basically.
Great. Well, as far as being a member of the FIRE community, I'm a little unusual in that I'm 58 years old. You know, generally it's among the young people, but I really like the movement. I started out as a teacher about age 27. I was kind of late to actually taking on a career. Prior to that, I was playing basketball and traveling. I played basketball in college at Davidson.
Yeah, so I know that that was a lot to unpack, Jerry. That story was fantastic. I mean, I want to start a little bit towards the beginning. You were in debt and you decided you wanted to get out of that debt. That was before you found the FIRE movement, is that right?
Yeah, we're talking 1996 here, and the FIRE movement was nothing. And I always tell everybody, I read a book around 96 called Cashing In on the American Dream, How to Retire at 35. So that kind of gave me some fire-like thinking in my head. But yeah, around then, my wife owed $25,000 and I owed $20,000 for our graduate student loans. And I'll, you know, the first year I was making my payments, I think I put like my first payment, I did do like two whole checks on it. And I kind of got settled in my job and I wasn't in attack mode. But at some point, I think I was out buying a CD in Saudi Arabia, Bossa Nova CD. And I was like, deliberating, should I spend $15 on this? And I thought to myself, hell, you know, your money's not even yours yet. You don't need to be spending money other than, you know, food and just, you know, getting over the hump. So I didn't buy that. And I just started, you know, I would take a paycheck and squeeze it as long as I could. And then I would send checks in just like $3,000 at a time. I think I was making about $40,000 a year then. So, you know, I knocked off mine. Then I started chipping away at my wife's. And we got that done. But yeah, we were pretty maniacal about getting up to zero. And I remember hitting zero, feeling free again.
Yeah. I mean, that is a huge milestone, especially for a lot of people now. I mean, a lot of people who have 100K, 200K in student loans. I remember the first time I hit zero, it was refreshing just to be back at square one, just to be broke, basically.
Yeah, you're a free man again.
So once you hit zero, then you told me, or you told us that you reached about 100K in savings. That takes some determination as well. What got you to that point to say, not just that you're a free person, debt free, but you're now going to start building wealth?
Well, I did know that I needed some wealth if I was going to go and explore the world and do my thing in South America. So I really, you know, that book I mentioned earlier, the Paul Terhorst book, I did realize I needed some assets and I needed to get those assets to work for me. So that my goal was at least 100,000. I didn't realize that I was going to need a lot more probably. But, you know, once I got that 100, you know, paying down the debt and then saving money and investing, they kind of go hand in hand. They both require discipline. It's just that now, instead of you taking money and sending it off, you're putting it on your side of the ledger, as I like to say.
Yeah.
And that really kind of just keeps building, you know, because when you're investing, you know, we've been through a long bull market here. There've been some, you know, a lot of peaks and valleys, but all in all, it's gone up. But when you start seeing your money double and you realize that some years you make more off your investments than you did by your contributions, right? That's a great feeling. So
definitely. Yeah.
The surprise to me was I was able to do that stateside as a teacher because I, you know, that kind of went against the narrative we all live with.
Right, right. And you definitely don't hear a lot of stories of millionaire teachers. So you're an outlier in that sense. And what I love about your story, too, is that you guys, like you said, you really started late, considering a lot of these stories that you hear about the FIRE movement. People retire early at 30 or in their 20s. But what's amazing is, even though you consider it late, you're still well ahead of a traditional retirement path. And you've made it years before that, before 65. So that goes to show that it really, if you have that determination, you know what you're doing. You know, even if you're in your 30s, in starting fresh, you can still retire at a young age.
Well, yeah, and in a lot of ways, even though I wasn't retired those years working, let's say around 2014, I didn't need the job. I already had like well over about $700,000, $800,000 to my name. So that gives you a totally different outlook on any job you're in. And I actually remember the interview with the principal. He looked at my spotty resume and he's like, I just have to ask you, you know, how long will you stay? And I just said, 2 to 3 years. And he's like, I just admire your honesty. And I got hired, you know, because the beauty is that they always need Spanish teachers, it seems, you know. So, and he was looking for 3 at the time, and I was the first one he interviewed. So, yeah, it just gives you, having money gives you not only options, it just changes your attitude about work. You know, I've always known, or I've known for getting on 10 years now, that I could leave a job and take a break and just come back because, you know, there are always teaching jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I needed another one, we actually talked about taking some online jobs this year. My wife and I decided against it just because you lose your headspace and, you know, but those things are still out there. I see them all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it is completely different working when you know that you can, or you have the option to step away if needed for family or for your own mental sanity. So I'd love to now just talk a little bit about this 457 plan that you've used as basically a secret weapon. I don't think a lot of people know about it. Maybe some people in the FIRE community. And this is something that I've used personally because of your content. This is something that I found at my employer. Not a lot of my colleagues knew about this plan. And so I actually started taking advantage, and I was trying to tell everyone about it, but they just couldn't grasp the fact that this was an additional 401k or 403b. So can you talk about that secret, I guess, weapon for teachers, really, that you can maximize about $40,000, $41,000 pre-tax, is that right, each year?
Yeah, I believe now, and I'm older, so what is it? I think it's 26 with the catch-up contribution.
I think so.
Let me just go back and say around 2010, starting about then, that's when I started doing both the 403B and the 457. And like you said, it just effectively doubled my contribution amounts. Then when I turned 50, I also got to do the catch-up contributions to both the 403B and the 457. So, you know, my wife and I, we've had many years where we say well over six figures when you figure those two accounts, plus we use a traditional IRA and a health savings account. So I think our biggest year was 2019. We saved $130,000.
That is incredible.
That's insane. I know.
And so that's pre-tax mostly?
Yeah. Yes. I think that 130 figure, I threw like $1,000 in a mutual fund so I could say that I did hit 130. But I mean, I'm very weak on the taxable brokerage accounts. I have I think I have $450 in that account right now. So I'm almost all pre-taxed.
That's amazing. Your tax bills must be non-existent.
Well, you've read that free money post, right?
Yes, yes. I encourage all the listeners to check out free money post. You do one every year, it seems, and it's fantastic. I love it.
I get so many requests for that if I'm late on it, because sometimes I'm waiting for the tax law to shake out and I don't want to write something. It's just based on speculation. And it shocks me where people are like, hey, where's the post? You know, like, patience, I'm waiting for this to come through. But let me say one thing I do a little different with the 457. Being that I'm a teacher, our 403B and 457 plans tend to be variable annuity products, and they have a lot of fees. So I don't invest in those products. I just park the money in a fixed account, like a, you know, mutual fund account, get my 2% and take my licks with inflation. But when I separate service is when these two things happen. I moved my 403b money to my traditional IRAs at Vanguard. And then two, now I can start drawing on that 457 money for living expenses. And that money comes in as taxable income, but I'm deciding how much money I'm going to pay in taxes by deciding how much I'll take in as income. Now, and I have rolled some of that magic money just to my traditional IRA at times, if I had a whole lot of money there. But full disclosure, I'm down to my last $26,000 of magic money that I'm going to take that out in January. Okay. And that's going to get me to my 59 and a half, which will happen next June.
That is perfect. Perfect distribution drawdown phase. I mean, calculated that one. Great.
Squeaking in there. Yeah. And you know, another thing that we have done that I don't see many people have done this, but around 2013, I started the 72T, where I actually started taking IRA distributions. And I looked online and figured out the calculation wasn't hard to do. I mean, I have an MBA, so I could follow an example and get my number. And so my wife and I, every year, we've gotten about $18,000 in change to start the year. And that's not a lot of money, but to have $18,000 hit your bank account, that's just a good tailwind in your sale to start the year. So,
right,
you know, 59 and a half, I'll be able to access those other accounts that I have. And age 60, I get my teacher's pension. So,
yep, that sounds
feel flush with money.
Yes, exactly. That sounds great. And so you're right. Not a lot of people discuss the 72T just because of how complicated it can be. But to be clear, I think everything with the 72T distributions, the end point is 59 and a half, right? Is that how it is? And then it turns into a regular IRA or pre-tax bucket.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I think what scares a lot of people is that you have to keep taking them to 59 and a half. I think you're allowed one change of your distribution formula, but it apparently has a lot of triggers a lot of back taxes on every distribution you've taken up to that. So truth be told, knowing what I know now, I probably wouldn't have done that. I probably just would have done Roth conversions and kind of taken them that way with the 5-year staggered. If you read Justin McCurry, Rudy Good, he has a good article explaining how he does that. But yeah, I can see why people don't want to do 72T, and I wouldn't think they were crazy.
Well, it's interesting that I've never met anybody who's done a 72T, but now that I'm thinking about it, it seems as though the risk gets less and less. Let's say you do a 72T in your 20s or your 30s, the risk is higher than doing it in your 40s or your 50s. So does that sound about right?
Yeah, I didn't really think of that because I had a big enough cash position that where I could just kind of pull out. And within that IRA, I was just having dividends and capital gains paid to a money market. Mm-hmm. Automatically. And if I thought I had too much money, then I would flip over and buy a few more shares in the VTSAX. So I guess I learned a lot about managing distributions by doing that and kind of investing within
pool
of money. You know, it's weird because as FIRE people, we're in the savings and distribution phase kind of simultaneously. And that's not traditional retirement planning.
No, not at all. It seems like you got a nice mixture of a lot of different things. The 72T, you've got a couple 457 plans you can draw down. You've got income as well. So there's a lot there, and you kind of can pick, basically your tax range, your wages for the year. You can do a lot of things there.
Yeah, and I guess I need to mention this. I will use my HELOC strategically to get me through a year. Like if I don't want to go past a certain amount of income, I'll use my HELOC to strategically get over that last 4 to 6 weeks of a year. And the HELOC's a little dangerous, I find, you know, because, but it's a big pool of money. And my first home, I probably wasn't very good with that, to be honest. I'm much better now. But yeah, I'm always trying to control my income level because it'll control my tax bill, you know, keep it within check.
Yeah. And it definitely helps to embrace frugality during that process.
Yeah, you know, frugal living is one of my pillars of FIRE. You know, you gotta have a nice lifestyle that doesn't cost you a lot of money. And we can always, rev up our spending and get our lifestyle, but that's just not sustainable. You know, that's a problem with a lot of people. They're not willing to tweak that.
Right. And I love your, thank you for bringing up the pillars of fire. So I want to get into that because it kind of brings us back to the roots, I think, of the FIRE movement. A lot of times we talk about increasing our income, and it's true. You can increase your income to an unlimited level, and it is an important factor. But I do like these seven pillars because it is, you really can't go wrong with it, I should say. If you do apply these seven pillars, you're pretty set up for financial success. So if you don't mind, maybe we can talk a little bit about a couple. We've talked about frugal living. Debt avoidance is another big one, I see.
Yeah. I guess I have them listed and I have them weighted as well. And the one I have weighted the highest is just good old hardcore savings. To me, that's 30% of the formula. You can earn a lot of money, but if you don't save it, you're right back where you started. And that's unfortunately where I see a lot of people, friends, families, coworkers, acquaintances, and it's a little frustrating to me. But, you know, people, they've got to find their path. But I would just always say, you know, hardcore savings. You know, the more you can save, the faster you can move down the fire path. And let me just say, as we probably mentioned here, I've used my tax advantage accounts, 403B, 457, traditional IRAs, and health savings accounts. That is an easy way to save, and you're going to see it comes up in another pillar here. I'll link it here in a second. The other thing is debt avoidance. I understand people have to have a mortgage. I understand that. But if you're at a point in life where you don't have student loans and big car payments and credit card debt, I would just say, other than a mortgage, you know, avoid taking on lots of debt and lots of monthly payments, because by themselves, they don't appear to be that significant. But when you start adding them up, they add up. And then two, when you factor in your debt is paid with after tax dollars. So if you're going to have a $100 payment, you need to factor in about $130 of earned income. And there's a disconnect there for most people. So, you know, debt avoidance has been key for us. When I didn't have any money, I didn't have debt. And when I started getting money other than a mortgage, I've never had a car payment, for example. Just bought used cars and drove them for 12 years and things like that.
I like that. I'm on the same boat as, I'm in the same wagon as that. Yep.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes when you're putting a little money for a repair, you're like, oh God, but eventually you'll know when it's time to get rid of it. It'll just be too frequent. The other, and like I said, I put about a 20% weight to debt avoidance in my mind. So that's 50% of the equation right there. Income maximization, 10%. And what I mean by that is, as a teacher, you know, I never really had a side hustle at home, but I did have a side hustle at school. I did extended day, which meant I didn't have a planning period. I taught the fourth, we're on a block schedule. I taught 4 out of 4 every day. And, you know, it was hard, but doing it both semesters paid me 25% more. And seeing how I was putting that money in those retirement accounts, I knew where that effort was going. The other things I did is I coached basketball and cross country, and I've been in a JV soccer coach. My wife is, you know, sponsors clubs like TSA, is a tech association. I forget the acronym that she taught. Sorry, honey. But, you know, we're always like, you know, as a teacher, they always have side jobs they want you to do. And I would always tell a teacher, take something you're familiar with, because they're going to get you into something, you know. You don't want me doing SAT prep but when you get those little pay bumps, you need to make them count. I've also did I went beyond a master's degree. I did a specialist degree to earn a pay bump. And my wife did as well. From that, we earned $12,000 more a year teaching the same job. Okay. So that's income maximization. Tax minimization is my fourth pillar. You know, April 15th, you shouldn't be howling at the moon about how much you're paying in taxes. In our case, we've just used our tax advantage accounts to keep our income about the end of the 10% tax bracket. So many years I pay like, I don't know, $1,000 federal income tax consistently. but that's because I have a tax plan. Now, if I didn't do tax planning, I might be paying $8,000 to $10,000 a year. So you've got to have a tax plan to minimize your tax payment. The fifth pillar is prudent investing. You know, what that means is you got to know how much you're going to, your investments are costing you. End of the day, we use index funds. You know, we're VTSAX people. Fidelity and Schwab also have very good index choices at rock bottom cost. Those funds have been very useful for us to grow our wealth. And, you know, prudent investing meant that I would have to quit my job to get my money to those more cost-effective accounts because, as I mentioned, I had fee-bloated variable annuity products. And the last thing here is frugal living is my sixth pillar. We already talked about that. Just, I think your previous guest, Paula Pan, has a good way of putting it. Mind the gap, know what you're earning, and know what you're spending, and you want to grow your gap. Well, frugal living allows you to keep a surplus. You know, if you earn $3,000 and you're living off $1,500, it's working, you know. But if you're earning three and you're spending $3,500, it's not working. You've got to monitor that. So frugal living to me means, you know, we bought a house in a low cost of living area. We paid $68,000 for our 3-2 brick ranch house. It's a great place. We love it. It's got a good school. We paid off our car. We have a Prius, so we don't spend a lot in gas. We eat out occasionally, but when we do, we might go to a lunch buffet. You know, we cook at home. But we do, you know, those are your big three expenses. We keep our phone bill and our internet bill in check, things like that. And, you know, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this. My wardrobe consists primarily of Costco and Sam's clothes at this point. I look like a slap.
No, there's no, you do not have to be embarrassed about that. But I think this part is interesting to talk about the frugal living just real quick, because I know that sometimes it can get a bad rap, but we're not advocating here for any sort of, you know, for frugal limit to the extreme. Nobody's asking you to, you know, do the extreme stuff. You just, whatever you're comfortable with. Is that right?
Yeah, I am definitely not going to recycle napkins and things like that. That's insane. But frugality seems to have a bad name because people go to cheapskate real quick in their mind. But most people, if they saw me, they would have no idea that I'm frugal. Let me mention last thing I haven't talked about a lot. Another pillar of FI I consider is wealth multipliers, just things that make you feel wealthier. And I mentioned one already. I call it the lunch buffet circuit. You know, when you're not working and you can go to, like my wife, we went to this Mexican buffet in Valdosta this week. It was like $10 a person. It was really good. But if you're working or teaching, you can't even go do that. You know, it was really nice. It was a $20 meal. So I like living an off-peak existence. You know, when I can go to Walmart at 8 or 9 in the morning and pick up stuff. And it's just really nice going to, swimming against the grain like that. And another thing I would mention under that bracket of wealth multipliers, I'm very big into travel hacking and building points. We're getting ready to take a trip this July to Ecuador and to Mexico. We're going to take the fall off and homeschool our son and let him work on his Spanish. But, you know, I'm not going to pay for those flights, you know, full freight. I'm using my points, and I'll be end up paying probably, I don't know, all the trips, probably about $1,000 this summer. Makes me feel wealthier. That's why I refer to these as wealth multipliers. And then the last thing I'd say about that is just kind of honing your routine, you know, with workouts and self-study and things like that. I mean, you know, it's just nice having your day and doing what you want to do, but you have to kind of develop that. It just doesn't happen. You know, I use the 80-20 model.
Right.
You know, I do the 20 things that give me the most enjoyment, or 20% of things that give me 80% of the enjoyment. So those are my pillars.
Yeah, I love them. Thank you for running through that. And the wealth multiplier, I'm glad you touched on that as well, just to, you know, talk about that real quick. It does make a big difference, basically, going to a happy hour, for example, and getting a great deal, enjoying some drinks and food at basically half price, or traveling the world and using your points and basically just paying the tax on those flights. Those are huge. And I actually never really thought about that, but just another part of the pillars that everybody, I think, should be using.
Well, my friends, they seem to think, and I don't know why, because I am kind of, I watch my money, obviously. they think I'm paying for these tickets. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. It'd be like $1,500 bucks each way to get them, or $1,000. I'm just not going to do that. So the travel rewards has really helped a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we covered a lot there. And I just want to also mention one quick thing about the 457 before we move past that is you seem to use that 457 plan almost as an emergency fund as well. Is that right? Is can a 457 plan be used basically as an emergency fund?
Well, yes and no. No, in the sense that until you quit your job, you're not going to be able to access that money without penalty. But in a worst case scenario, and you lost your job, then that money would be there. And so that's why I always figured I never had an emergency fund once I started with that 457. Who am I kidding? I never had an emergency fund. I was flying by the seat of my pants. But I always knew, you know, when I saw that get to 10, 15, 20,000 bucks, it's like, well, if something really happened, you know, I can just tap that. And that was nice to know. Give me peace of mind.
Yeah, I thought that was something, again, another concept that I had just never thought about. But yes, emergency fund, you're right. If you didn't lose your job, but you still need the money, it wouldn't be available. But a lot of people worry, including myself, if you lose your job, what are you going to do? You need an emergency fund. And I just never realized that 457 could actually serve you at that time, which is a big plus.
Well, that coupled with my home equity line of credit, I knew I had some funds I could get to, and that is peace of mind.
Yep. So just transitioning to something a little lighter, not necessarily about money, but I heard you went to Davidson. So we're recording this on June 2nd. The finals are tonight, and Steph Curry is playing. Are you a big Steph Curry fan?
Yes, I really am. And I just read the article yesterday in Sports Illustrated, and basically they were arguing he might be the most dominant player ever. Now, I've got my own thoughts on this. And I was a basketball coach in Eccles County, and I used to tell my players before he broke out, I would say, guys, I'm just telling you, and I've seen a lot of basketball. I played against All-Americans and NBA players. I always told him, I said, Stephen Curry will make you doubt your own eyes. You know, when you see him live, like at the floor level, it's unbelievable. And I'm talking about Stephen Curry in college. So, you know, I think that when it gets right down to it, what Steph's great contribution to basketball is he proved that three is greater than two. And everyone is having to play a three-point dominant game. And if, you know, he and Klay Thompson, the way they can stroke it, it's just kind of like they get to tee it up 10 to 12 times a game each. And you're off, you're probably going to lose, even though you have a great post player. And so it really puts pressure on the other team to shoot threes. And if, you know, you've seen a lot of the league is catching up, but I just kind of view that Stephen Curry revolutionized the game. And the other thing I have to say here, and in the article yesterday in Sports Illustrated, referred to the term gravity. He draws so much defensive attention. And I remember I would watch him in the pros, and I'm thinking, what would I scheme as a coach here? And I used to always just say, I don't know. And, you know, hat tip to Cleveland Cavaliers that year they beat them. They played like three perfect games. I mean, they were miraculous games almost. And they did get them one time, but it's not easy, you know, to play like that. Stephen Curry is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And he's a nice guy. I will say that. I haven't met him. He's a genuine person.
Nice, nice. I got my money on Golden State. I'm a big Heat fan, Miami Heat fan, just being here in Florida. And we were so close to meet you guys in the finals. But, you know, since Boston won, I'll give them credit. And I'll still root for the Golden State Warriors. I think they just got a great team. It's to me, it's clear, especially with Poole emerging. Ooh. I mean, this isn't an NBA podcast, but I just got to, you know, talk a little basketball with you.
Yeah, it's fun to watch him. I agree. You know, Poole is exceptional.
Yeah.
Slithery.
Exactly, exactly. So moving on, we're talking about college, though, and you said you have a son who is in preparation. He's 16 and he's preparing for college. I think you mentioned off camera here that he currently has some hours accredited towards college. How are you doing that, or how are you planning that college degree for him in the most cost-effective manner?
Yes. When the pandemic happened, a lot of us were on the computer, me included. And somewhere along the line, I came across Sophia Learning, sophia.org. And they offer what are called ACE courses, American Council on Education. That's what ACE means. And so what the ACE courses, they follow a curriculum and they teach a course. Now, Sophia does not grant you credit, but universities, many universities will take their courses and give you credit for it. So I took like ancient Greek philosophers just to see what I thought. And, you know, it was open PDF files for the test and it's pass fail. You know, a lot of people could pass those. So I ended up, you know, I'm a little maniacal at times, and I basically did 68 credit hours in 2 months. I did 2 years of college in 2 months. And then I realized, well, look, my son's sitting here at home, and I got him to do a college readiness course, and he was getting ready to go into high school that year. So he just finished eighth grade. And then he took U.S. history and art history and things like that. And, you know, he did well in those courses. You know, when I say well, it made at least, you know, an 80-something to a 90-something. And so basically I just started bribing him to do those courses. So I was paying him $25 a course, and boy, he was working hard. And but anyway, he has 70 credit hours on. He has a college transcript at Excelsior College in New York. We've sent all those ACE courses to that university where he has a transcript. So he's done over 2 years of college. So our total cost have been, I would say, $500 for him to do all that.
Wow.
Yeah. So the plan is we're just going to get him through his core and have his electives done. And then so maybe during his senior year, he can start taking some upper level courses if he wants. But he's probably going to graduate from that school in New York. They're very flexible on their credit. And they are accredited university. And he and I have talked about grad school down the line because, you know, my undergrad degree, I was not very mature like a lot of people doing undergrad. So my philosophy is like getting through a degree, and then he'll kind of start figuring out what he's really interested in. If he wants to go to grad school, great. Maybe he wants to do certifications and work in the tech world, he can do that. So, but I just don't think you have to spend tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars on degrees. There's so many options out there now.
Yep. And I had to mention that because I thought that that was just fantastic. I mean, and again, you have that background of knowing what education is like. From being in education for your whole career. So you're essentially giving him a fantastic head start through college. And yeah, you're right. He doesn't have to come out of college burdened with, you know, like myself, over 100,000 in student loans. That just sets you back so many years in your life.
Well, and I will tell the listeners, I did write two blog posts on basically credit acquisition experiments that I did. And the first one talked about that my experience at Sophia. And there's another one I did. I did 2 years of college in a month through some CLEP testing. And yeah, I mean, I know I'm a little crazy to do that. I get it. People are like, and you know, well, I'm not some super genius either, because these are freshman, sophomore level courses. But I took 17 CLEP tests over 32 days. And I got, I think it was 66 credit hours. So
that's awesome.
Insane. But, you know, I did this so I could write about it and tell people, because it's an option, you know. So, yeah, I have done over 5 years of college through, like, alternative education. And I tallied it up, my total expenses for the 5 years of college. And this is an honest estimate, about $714.
That is incredible. I mean, the difference in that between the regular tuition, I can't imagine, but
I think higher ed's going to send an assassin to quiet me.
Yeah, we need to keep this on the low for only our podcast listeners here. This is why you guys listen. You're getting the secret stuff here. But I am going to link all that information up, the 457, the free money posts as well, and of course the college hack that you just uncovered here. So Jerry, thank you so much for taking some time out and sharing all this. You're a wealth of knowledge, and I really appreciate everything you've taught us, including myself. So what's coming up for you? Anything exciting? Where can listeners find you? And then also what you got coming up?
Yeah, I blog infrequently at millionaireeducator.com. I prefer doing podcast interviews these days. It's more fun for me. But I do have some things in the hopper. My biggest focus, I find a lot of my mental space is going to directing my son and kind of coaching him through his college work. You know, being that he is 16, think back to when you were 16 and the thought of doing college is probably not very high up in your list of priorities. So the big thing, we're renovating our house a little bit here. That should be done in the next month or so. And then we're going to, like I said, Ecuador and Mexico to check it out. My wife and son and I, we're residents of Mexico, so we can go and stay as long as we want. We always have a nice time there. And when I'm out too long, I start to really miss it. So we're really excited to go travel and relive our Mexican experience.
Awesome. Yeah, I think a lot of people are, after the couple last 2 years that we've had, I think a lot of people are itching to get back on a plane and go somewhere new or back to, you know, their roots. I just recently took a trip back to Philadelphia where I met my wife, and it was just fantastic, just reminiscing a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wish you luck and in your travels. And again, thank you so much for taking some time here, and we'll catch you next time, hopefully in season 3. All right. What a great episode. I hope you guys agree. And again, thank you, Jerry, for taking the time to come on the show and share those amazing tips for us. And a lot of the resources that are shared are going to be in the show notes below. I went ahead and linked those all together so you guys can take a look at his website as far as his free money post, which everybody loves, his post about hacking college, and his post about the 7 reasons to love your 457 plan. So what jumped out about this episode to me was just the fact that he was using this 457 account to essentially control his tax rate. And what was amazing is he was using it almost as an emergency fund. Of course, he had a few other options as well. But yeah, he was using it as close to an emergency fund, but also as an FU money account, and also in the ability to lower his tax rate to essentially 10% or to whatever he wanted is fantastic. So I thought that part was amazing. And again, this 457 account, if you want to check with HR or your employer or future employers to see if they have it, do your own research. Of course, this isn't financial advice. This isn't tax advice either. I'm not an accountant and I'm not a financial planner. However, go ahead and take a look at these accounts because they can help you, as seen by this episode and this example. They can help you basically double your retirement savings and double your or lessen your tax burden by double as well, because this is all pre-tax. So go ahead and check to see if your employer offers an account like this. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But if they do, do your research and then carefully consider if this is something that you guys want to take advantage of as well, especially teachers. I know a lot of teachers listen to the show, and I think that that would be something that can help them along the way as well. And I'm not a teacher, and I had access or still have access to this 457 account at my employer. So you don't have to be a teacher. That's why I say go ahead and check just to make sure. You might find something amazing in that HR department, and you never would have thought that, huh? But anyways, thank you guys for listening. This is going to be, that's going to wrap up the show. Again, subscribe to the show, share it with anybody that you think it might help, and thank you guys for listening. So until next week.